Hi, everyone. I'm Sam Frank. I'm an editor of Triple Canopy. We're organizing today's events as part of 50 days of events here at MoMA PS1. The series is called Speculations. The future is blank. So asking a lot of people to fill in the blank in however, not however they'd like. We're really asking them, artists, writers, technologists, scientists, political thinkers, to describe a future they'd like to see realized, even if their optimism is dark in some sort of way, and then read that future that they'd like back into the present. So that means on weekends we're having all kinds of events, and then during the week on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays we're having 2 p.m. discussions and 4 p.m. lectures. Including tomorrow, John Crowley is here at 2 and 4, and I hope you come back. Really excited about today. As we were discussing this idea of thinking about the future from and thinking about the humanities and the sciences, say, together at the same time, which often feels really difficult, in a world where a lot of the futurism is coming from, is expressed in Wired or in Silicon Valley, and that's great as far as it goes, but it feels a little bit limited. Kim Stanley Robinson's work and both his novels and interviews and essays and other talks he's given, seemed like something that held it all together in a really useful way for us as we thought about where else we wanted to go. Both fiction and what fiction can do, and science and politics and everything else, and flexibly. I mean, he revisits a lot of the same things in his work, but changes them around and thinks them differently each time. And so I think he was the first person we emailed as we were sending out 1,000 emails to book all those events. So he's going to give a talk right now. I guess we're calling it a keynote talk, loosely titled, What is the Future For? And then he'll be back at 4 p.m. with John Crowley to talk about some of the ideas in this talk and answer questions. And I mean, he's going to answer questions today, but I mean, now. But so we hope today really kind of generates things that will pop up again as the summer goes on. And I'd like to welcome Stan.
Well, thank you, Sam, for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming. This title, What is the Future For?, is interesting and provocative, and I'm going to try to just think about it here on stage for a while and then take questions. And my first feeling is that the shape of the future in our minds is getting strange and is different from what it has been for most of human history. And it's because of the coming climate change and what you could, which we use as shorthand for a larger environmental crisis, perhaps a collapse. So we have this notion of catastrophe looming in front of us. And then also, on the other hand, our growing technological powers, the fact that we've already got 7 billion people alive on the planet is a kind of a technological achievement, especially if you think of technology as being more than machinery, as being hardware and software both, so that things like law and systems in general are a kind of technology. So you can think of even justice as a technology that keeps us from killing each other. When there are more people on the planet than the planet will actually sustain in its ordinary biological state. So we have this technological achievement already that looks like it has the potential to do an even better job than it has been doing, because the first iterations were dirty technologies, and we're getting cleaner and cleaner technologies. And this might include the social technologies that I want to keep adding into the talk. So, and then there's a missing middle, because we have catastrophe, and then we have utopia. But the idea that we go somewhere in between them is beginning to disappear for us, because the potential for catastrophe out of the middle way is getting larger and larger. So let me talk a little bit more about the catastrophe, but not for too long, because I don't think that's what we're here for. But it has to be mentioned. You know, we just hit 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere last month, and that was about the first time in 2 or 3 million years that the atmosphere had had that much CO2. And at that level of CO2, the temperatures are typically about 8 degrees Celsius higher than they are now. And so we haven't got those temperatures yet, but the forcing action of all this CO2 in the atmosphere is likely to make it a lot hotter, in a way that's much faster than has ever happened in ordinary geological history. Also, there is ocean acidification. The pH of the ocean has changed measurably, and this is quite an accomplishment for human beings to have done that when you think how big the oceans are. About a third to a half of the CO2 that we put into the atmosphere as waste from our carbon burning is taken into the ocean and doesn't stay in the atmosphere, but then it acidifies the ocean. And about a third of humanity's food comes out of the ocean, and the acidification could kill the bottom of the food chain, the plankton, the smallest creatures. And as we all know from schools like this one, when the bottom of the food chain goes away, the rest of the food chain also will collapse. So as things heat up, there's also the possibility that release a lot of methane into the atmosphere, which is about 20 times more of a greenhouse gas than CO2, although it doesn't last in the atmosphere as long. But this, too, is a problem that we could get things warm enough that it would then shoot past various tipping points and start getting hotter in a way that we have no capability of stopping. And you can compare it to ocean acidification. We think about the atmosphere, it's like your thermostat in a room. Maybe we can turn down the temperature. Groups like 350.org, they're thinking all we have to do is take 50 parts per million of CO2 out of the atmosphere and we've turned down the temperature in the room. Ocean acidification isn't amenable to human change. They calculate, the British Royal Society calculates that you'd have to take apart most of southern England's chalk downs and toss it into the ocean as limestone to deacidify the oceans, and that's not going to happen. It's essentially impossible. And we could shoot past all kinds of points to where stopping the heating up will be impossible to human powers, no matter how high-tech we become. So this is the catastrophe. And it's been calculated that we can burn about 500 more gigatons of carbon before we have hit the limits. And a giga is a billion, so 500 billion tons of a gas. How do you think that? I don't think you can. I can't think it. I don't know what a ton of a gas is in terms of volumetrics. But so it's one of these numbers that we tell ourselves that we can't really physicalize, which is part of our problem. But so we can burn about 500 more gigatons, and that gives us maybe 30 to 50 more years of burning carbon the way that we are now before we have cooked ourselves effectively. But also, we have identified 2,500 gigatons of carbon in the world already that can be mined and burned. So we can burn 500, we've identified 2,500. In our economic system, it is more economical to burn the 2,500 than it is to shift to alternative means, because the infrastructure is already there. So effectively, we have to leave 2,000 gigatons of carbon in the ground or under the ocean, or else we have even more, we've cooked ourselves even more than we're going to already. And so I did a back of the envelope calculation, and it literally was on the back of an envelope, so you can't really trust the numbers here, but I tried to calculate the cost or the price, the monetary value of 2,000 gigatons of carbon in today's market is about $1,600 trillion. So there are companies and nation states that will be intent to mine, sell, and burn that $1,600 trillion worth of carbon, and yet we can't do it, or else we've cooked the planet. And yet we don't have a good way of stopping economic activities from going forward in the world that we live in now. So this has caused many people to conclude that we are, in fact, doomed, that civilization is doomed, and that catastrophe is upon us, and there's nothing that we can do about it now. And you even hear quite often, and this is particularly true of the op-ed pages of newspapers that are very interested in keeping the status quo, you very often heard it said that humanity is doomed partly because we're not good at planning. We were evolved to fight or flight, and then when we have to do some planning over long term, that it just isn't in human nature to do that. Well, I want to say that that view of humanity is not factually true. We are actually good at long-term planning. It's the reason that we're here at all. In evolutionary terms, the ability to plan through the winters and the springtimes for the food that will keep you alive to the next summer has been something that we've lived with ever since we became human beings. That from the very start, humanity has been a technological species that has included long-term planning of all different kinds of sorts, and then we've dealt with climate change before. It's also true in the modern world in terms of long-term planning. We have mortgages, debts, hedge funds, laws, contracts. So we do long-term planning all the time now, and it's bizarre that the people who are talking about how we're not good at long-term planning are also the same people who are saying that the future is really bought and sold and cannot be changed because it's a commodity that has been purchased, and including us. So effectively, when people say that humanity is not good at planning, they usually have bad plans of their own that they are inflicting on us. So cognitively and legally, we are pretty good at planning, and now we need to plan. And so let's take a look at the other view of things, since that's the view of catastrophe, and I think it's pretty clear that it's real. But what's the utopian view? Well, we've got 7 billion people, and we're probably going to hit 9 billion people before we top out, just from the demographic pressures of young people having kids. What you would want is that everybody on the planet has food, water, shelter, clothing, healthcare, and education equally, and that all of the other animals, especially the big mammals, all the mammals really, who are in danger of extinction, are in good shape also, that all of the humans and the biosphere that supports it and all the other creatures who are our fellow beings on this planet are all in good shape together. Now, is it physically possible? Yes, it is physically possible. It would take really good clean tech that has to do with agriculture principally, but also everything else that we do as a modern civilization being done in a clean way, which means not burning very much more than 500 gigatons of carbon and being clean another way in terms of the wastes and pollution of our civilizational efforts being reprocessed by the earth fast enough that it doesn't poison the earth for future production. So that is possible. And here's where you get not just clean technologies as machinery, so that you have, say, renewable energy, and you have solar power, and you have little electric cars that are powered by the sun and being battery powered, and things that have already been invented and need to be implemented. But you also have inventions that we already have invented, like social justice. One of the problems of sustainability is population growth. It would be nice if there were as few humans as possible as we get through this crisis century. So what stops population growth fastest is women's empowerment and women's rights, human rights in general. But what we've seen around the world is a kind of an ongoing experiment in social technology, is that the moment that women have full control over their lives, the population rate drops from whatever it was, and sometimes it's like 5 or 7 kids per mom, down to 2.2 kids per mom, which is the replacement rate, or even under that to like 1.5 or 1.7 kids per mom, as you see in Japan and other countries in Europe. So what it comes down to is that when you live in a just society, you've stabilized population, just because of people doing what they want. It doesn't take any government coercion. It is actually an expression of control and liberty over one's own life. the natural reproductive urge having been satisfied and the hassle of having kids being unnecessary, you end up with about, you know, 1.8 to 2.2 kids per mom, and the moms are the ones that take the brunt of the biological pressure at the front end, you might say. So this is an example of social justice as a geoengineering technology, that the Earth itself, we can manipulate our impact on the Earth by the way that we organize our civilization, not in terms of hardware or technology, but in terms of systems and how we organize ourselves. So, and it's also true that although economics is a weird and problematic field, we do have already clean and renewable energies that are competing very effectively against carbon burning for power generation. Not so much for transport yet, but for power generation, many countries in the world are getting a third or a half of their power from wind and solar. And these are countries that have made the effort, and sometimes they include parts of the United States as well. So one of the things that's happening here is that carbon is an industry, has the infrastructure, and also has enough capital to kind of buy governments, to buy legislation, and give themselves subsidies. So that in a straight competition, solar and wind might be more economical, cheaper, as well as better than carbon. But carbon also gives itself breaks, both in the production of the carbon in the first place and in the distribution of it later, is basically being subsidized by us, even though it's very destructive. So there's one political battle that we're going to have to fight all along. And the political battles are going to be endless all across the board, because of this bad economics that we live within. It's essentially a kind of an algorithm that we put ourselves in called the market. So it would be great if it was an algorithm that worked, but in fact, when you look at the biosphere and what we're doing to it, it's not an algorithm that works on two or three different levels. We often call it the market, and the great pride of neoclassical economics about the market is that it comes to a price naturally. What they call a cumulative or competitive equilibrium, CE, which is really just the balance of supply and demand. You've got demand, you've got supply, you've got a completely free and transparent information, you've got no regulations bothering it one way or another. It's a very pure, simple algorithm, and you get a price that is the true price. But unfortunately, excuse me here, we'll get that later. It's not the true price, and here's why. Demand is that it be as cheap as possible, the price. Supply doesn't stay alive as a supplier unless it manages to produce the thing for as low a price as it can get away with and still survive. So both pressures, supply and demand, are pushing downward on prices. So we underprice everything. There's systemic underpricing of everything that we buy. And there's a name for this in classical economics, which is dumping. If you sell something for less than it costs to make it, they call it dumping. And if you do that to drive your competitors out of business, after which point you raise the price because you've got a monopoly, it's called predatory dumping. So there's an economic term for this, and World Trade Organization doesn't like predatory dumping. It's sort of semi-illegal or against their rules. Free market economists will say there's no such thing as dumping. Whatever you can get away with works. There shouldn't be any regulation on pricing whatsoever. But what we have in systemic predatory dumping, you have to ask, well, who are we putting out of business in this metaphor that I'm using? It would be the future generations. We are predating on the future generations in sort of a competition with them. And, you know, we're doing really well at beating the future generations because they're not really here to compete for themselves. Now, if you have things systemically underpriced regularly, then you've got, the way you're doing it is by way of externalities. You're saying that's not really a cost. That's a cost we're going to shift out of our calculations so that we can make the numbers work. We can sell something for a certain amount, still get a profit for it. And so that's how the dumping works, is by creating externalities. This is another problem with economics, is that there's really no such thing as an externality, because the biosphere ultimately is not an externality. And labor costs, which really means people at work, Labor is not an externality either, nor is it a cost that can be shoved down to the lowest level possible without immiserating, the 99%, or what we can call the precariat, where there used to be the proletariat, but now we all think of ourselves as middle class. So what we are is the precariat, because everybody is in a precarious situation financially. Nobody can count on their future earnings, their pensions, their health insurance. Everybody being precarious lives in fear and therefore will take whatever they can get. So it's a kind of a control technique, keeping everybody precarious like that. And what you ultimately get is a kind of multi-generational Ponzi scheme where the promise is that eventually, if the first generation works really hard and bootstraps their way up to sending the second generation to college, the second generation, it's often an immigrant story in America, will then go to college and they'll have a middle class life, and then their kids will have a middle class life, and some of their kids will have an upper class life, but in any case, everybody eventually will have a middle class life. But to sustain the world population of 7 billion at the levels of consumption that we are in America in our middle class life would take about 4 to 6 Earths to do it. In other words, it's a Ponzi scheme. There's going to come a generation where the payment can't be made, the system falls apart, is shown to be a sham, and they are left holding the bag and the damage. And this is what's happening. I sometimes think that maybe 2008 was the beginning of the reveal on the Ponzi scheme of our economic system. Other times I think really it's the whole 21st century that is going to be the long emergency. Because as the Ponzi scheme falls apart and the biosphere falls apart, we have to do restitution and reparation. And as I said before, we're talking about catastrophes. There are some things that you can't pay your way out of. In a way, what people have been saying all along is, well, the future generations are going to be richer than us, smarter than us, wealthier than us. We'll just do what we need to do. They'll do what they need to do. They'll pay their way out of it. But there's certain biological problems with that, in that if we push the environment past the tipping point that we are approaching rapidly, there's no paying your way out of it. You simply are living on Jungle Planet, and you get the various science fictional post-collapse scenarios that really, those are fantasies. It's not even going to be as fun as the worst. It's not even going to be as fun as The Road. So now, how do we set true costs? And the true costs of things, maybe your car should cost maybe $300,000. Maybe your cell phone should cost $10,000. We don't know, because the supply-demand cumulative equilibrium is not the true cost. It's merely the price in the system, the game that we play. And this is where I don't know, and I don't think any of us knows. And I think this is the real problem for our moment, for the long emergency, and for the 21st century, is how do we play the true costs of our civilization so that we have the biosphere unharmed and future generations are able to live their life rather than being in some kind of disaster scenario. I often have framed this problem as science versus capitalism. And I think of science as being, and this is a very kind of idealistic view of things, but for me, science has been the effort to try to reduce suffering, the effort to try to make life more comfortable for human beings, to understand the world better and manipulate it for various human goods. So I think of science as a utopian force that from its very beginnings, you know, with the Royal Society or with Galileo, as modern science, but all along, going back into the Paleolithic, it was the way to try to make things better. And then capitalism has been a kind of residual feudalism liquidified, empowered, made global, but it, retaining feudalism's power hierarchy, the 1%, the royalty, the serfs and peasants, and the managerial class in between, the squires that kind of run the system for the aristocracy, that structure never left. We still live within that political structure, and that is what capitalism expresses, is the profit motive and power over other people. So science versus capitalism, and I was really startled, to tell you the truth, to hear the philosopher of science, Isabel Stengers, one of the most interesting and comprehensible of French thinkers, and she was talking a couple weeks ago at UC Davis, and she said this same thing, which I thought it was my own personal sock puppet view of history, but there she was saying it, a very high-powered philosopher of science. And not only that, but she said, it's like the old story of the scorpion and the frog. And I'll remind you of this story, which you may know. The scorpion and the frog have to cross a river or they're going to die. It's in flood. The frog can't see the other side. The scorpion can't swim. The scorpion proposes to climb on the frog's back. The frog will swim. The scorpion will navigate. They'll get across the other side. They'll both survive. So they're halfway out in the river when the scorpion stabs the frog in the back with the stinger. So this frog is dying and says to the scorpion, why did you do that? We're both going to die now. And the scorpion says, it's my nature. It's because of the way I am. Well, this is a scary thought if you think of the capitalist system as the scorpion and science as the frog. What do we do? How do you depoison the scorpion? How do you dodge its stings as you swim? I mean, the images get a little chancy at this point, but I think that this is a way of thinking our way through of this social problem of this century, the long emergency. Not just an environmental problem, not just a justice problem, but a peculiar mix of two systems struggling for power in human affairs, one of them trying to do good and survive, the other one hoping to impose hierarchy and political privilege of some people over others. And our project is a kind of multi-generational project. And so, as against the multi-generational Ponzi scheme, we have the multi-generational utopian project of getting through the century and creating a sustainable and decent civilization. And I think it's good to think of the multi-generational projects in terms of scaffolding. Because you see a lot of scaffolding around New York, and it's intuitively obvious. What happens is each generation can only build part of the scaffold, builds one level of the scaffold. It's a huge effort. It's a fight. But you can't immediately leap to the 70th floor to do your work. You can't leap to heaven, as they say in China. You can only do so much in one generation of your work and then have to trust that you've raised the bar, raised the scaffold level so that the next generation is doing even better work at an even higher level, making a cleaner and cleaner tech, making a more and more sustainable civilization, so that you don't say, we can't do it because we can't do it now, or we can't do it in our lifetimes, and then give up, which is a very common human emotion, to say, well, we can't do it, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, therefore it's impossible. Actually, that's not true. There's been about 400 generations since the end of the Ice Age, and each one of those 400 generations has done its best to try to scaffold things to the next level for their children, and we're just still caught in that. And so what's interesting is to think about what we have to do now. Now, as Americans, we probably have to consume less and more cleanly. And I think that brings up a really interesting and valid question, which is, will we still be okay? Will we still be us? Will we be comfortable? Will we feel like we feel now? Because if you're told that to survive, you have to change utterly, there's a certain amount of fear that you yourself won't be the same, because you are your habits, in a way. So there's this idea, well, utopia might be wonderful, but I'd rather be in the mess I'm in now, because at least I'm still me now. And so the question becomes, in a more practical sense, if everybody in the world, all 7 billion people, had to share equally the results of human efforts in the biosphere, of our resources and everything, would it be true that everybody would therefore then be poor, because there are so many more poor people than rich people? And I have heard quite mathematically sophisticated people say that if you look at the pyramid, the way it's structured right now, the Gini figures and so on, then if everybody had everything equally, then all of us would be dismally poor. And that's just the way mathematics works. But that, too, also turns out not to be quite true, because once you do the math and calculate it and then try it out as an experiment, you find different things. And I say this with some confidence because the Swiss, being the Swiss, very practical, lovely people, smart and interested in this problem, have a thing called the 2000-watt society. It's based in Basel and in Zurich. And the people in the 2,000-watt society have decided to live on 2,000 watts a year, which is what the 7 billion would have if it were divided equally amongst the 7 billion. The amount of energy that we generate comes to about 2,000 watts per person for the 7 billion. Now, Americans in general right now, just to give you some parameters on this, use about 12,000 watts a year. Europeans use 6,000, the Swiss use 5, the Chinese about 1,000, and in Bangladesh about 350 watts per year. So you see the range of possibilities. And because there are billions of very, very poor people on this planet, the average comes to the 2,000. Well, what these Swiss people have found is that their lives are not that much different. They do have the advantage of a small country with a tremendous infrastructure, but they are not suffering. They have enough food, water, shelter, clothing. And they even have, because of their own particular system, enough education and healthcare. So the implication here is that we're already doing it. And also the other implication is that when you're burning 12,000 watts, you're only really getting 2,000 watts worth of adequacy of life satisfaction, and the rest of it has been wasted. Either conspicuous consumption waste or just infrastructural bad design and dirty tech waste. But either way, not necessary for the golden mean of adequacy. Because it's pretty clear that when you get past adequacy into tremendous wealth, you also get mental problems, health problems, you get obesity, you get security guards, you get a miserable situation, so that not only is enough as good as a feast, as they say, for hundreds and thousands of years, but enough is even better than a feast, because a feast makes you sick. So this is, I think, something that can be pointed out and be a way of giving hope and encouragement, especially to the young people. Because I speak a lot at college campuses, and when I go to them, I'm looking at a crowd of people who are young, and that's kind of true here today also. You say to the young people, oh, sorry, I'm a baby boomer, you know, we were hippies, we did our best. In fact, we made a terrible mistake, the world is wrecked, and you have to live like saints. Sorry, it was good while it lasted, but good luck with your sainthood of living on reduced meats. Nobody looks at me happily when I say that message. And what I would want to do is correct that message to say that the way that we were living in those glory years was stupid anyway. It led to enormous amounts of bad health and mental illness. It was not actually true that it was happiness, because it wasn't healthy. And health and happiness are pretty much synonymous. So then, living cheaply, paying attention to the old Paleolithic realities of being outdoors, walking, cooking, talking with your friends all night long, dancing, sex. These Paleolithic activities are not only less expensive and more fun and healthier, but they burn a whole lot less carbon. They're low carbon burn. So, and then it becomes a matter of style. Do you have good style or do you have bad style? Do you live like some fat, rich person in polyester in a gated community? Or do you live in a city like New York on a small budget but have quality of life because you're hanging with other people and drinking coffee with them and talking to them face to face? This is the question I think is being answered by a younger generation that can define prosperity as these Paleolithic goods rather than as consumer commodity goods. And in that case, capitalism, I mean, 70% of the American economy right now is consumer goods, which means really the stuff that we don't need that isn't food, water, shelter, and clothing, 70%. Well, if that went away, what would happen? Growth would crash, blah, blah, blah. It would be a disaster in certain terms, but it would also be better for the planet and better for people's heads. So what kind of disaster is that? It's an economics disaster. And once again, you see the stupidity of that algorithm that we are living in right now. And I think I want to end by talking about monocausotaxophilia. This is a word invented by Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, and it means the love of single causes that explain everything. And we are all susceptible to monocausotaxophilia because it would be so much simpler if there was just one cause that explained everything, like God, like the free market or market dynamics, like government or like business. Any single cause that allows you not to think about everything else, you get what people refer to as fundamentalisms. There are religious fundamentalisms, but there are also market fundamentalists. These are those people that want that single cause because it makes things simpler. You don't feel so confused. You don't have to make so many decisions. And really, like when I talk about science versus capitalism, you can see that there's a kind of binary monocausotaxophilia in my analysis of world history. We all are susceptible to it. But you only have to look at the structure of a protein, or you have to think about the fact that 80% of the DNA inside your body is not human DNA, that the body is a forest, so to speak, or a biome. And the idea that one cause explains everything, it just doesn't work in this universe. It's not right in scientific terms. So we have to get used to that kind of messiness. And so if you have a vision of catastrophe, and you have utopia, and you're thinking, well, we'll just muddle down the middle, that history has always been muddling along between catastrophe and utopia. Why is it different now? What I'm saying is the middle way is now forestalled and has become part of catastrophe. That we don't have the freedom anymore to just kind of flow with history without making any grand cultural changes. That normality itself is creating the emergency. And therefore, utopia goes from being like a minor literary genre that I am over-interested in to being an actual escape and survival plan for all of humanity. It's utopia or nothing. The middle way doesn't work anymore. So I think this is a way of thinking of it, a way of going forward, a way of putting ourselves to work on the project. It is a project. It's a generational project. And this is another thing that I can offer to young people. Especially in the secular West, there's a crisis of meaning. What does life mean? You're born, you go through school for an infinite number of years, and then you get into a job, and you're already in debt when you start your job. You work and try to get yourself out of debt, and then at some point you die. Well, what's the point? What's the meaning of life? Well, we have now the meaning of life in the 21st century, which is the creation of a sustainable civilization. It's an actual project. It goes in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, also the humanities, also the social sciences, also the arts. In every human realm it's a broad front, and are going to have to be applied to this larger project of getting through the 20th century without catastrophe, which therefore means creating a kind of utopian sustainable civilization. And so once you have a project, it's better than not having a project. So even if it's a unprecedented physical emergency for the biosphere with the chance of a mass extinction event at the end of it, it's still better to have that than to have existential nothingness and nothing but commodity capitalism as your meaning of life. So that's my conclusion. We're going to, I would be happy to take some questions, but because of the live streaming and recording of this event, they would love to have the questions also amplified. So Sam is going to carry the mic halfway to you.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't been recording questions, but we're going to try today. I'm going to just start with one question, two questions. What is the future for? And two, I think we'll discuss more at four, but just a sketch of what literature or science fiction literature is for within the scheme would I think we can definitely go into more detail, but just a sketch might be nice.
Sure. And thank you for reminding me, and that probably is the true end of my talk, is what is the future for? Well, I was coming to it sort of, or got to it in a way. The future, since it never really comes, that we're always in the present, the future is for cognitive mapping. We think about the future in order to figure out what we do right now. And that brings up the idea out of existentialism of the project. The project is what you're doing in the present that includes a huge amount of futurity because it includes your plan. You're doing stuff in the present in order to prepare yourself for things that you want to do in the future. So the project is always a kind of science fiction scenario that you run for yourself. So this is all that the future is for. The future is always receding. We're never in it. This idea that my worthy constituency, William Gibson, said that the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. What he meant is the money is already here, but it's not evenly distributed. And he got it wrong, because the future is never here. It's always just something receding that we think about. So it's an idea that we have to orient our present action. And then science fiction comes into that as detailed, thick textured visions of various futures. You read them, you read enough science fiction, and you've read everything from the worst catastrophe to the best utopia and everything in between, and your sense of the future is strengthened thereby. You have more ideas, you're less surprised by things that happen in the news. Things make more sense, which is really what cognitive mapping is all about. That the buzzing, blurring confusion of modern reality, both in your senses and in your abstract thinking, get clarified if you are a science fiction reader. This is my claim. Don't you love this venue? This is very Greek. This is really a little amphitheater out of, I would say, Crete or...
And if you want to ask a question, kind of fill in this area and it's make it easier.
Hello. When you were talking about even resource distribution, you said 2,000 watts per person per year. I don't understand that. Is that total use of 2,000 watts? Is it continuous use of 2,000? Explain.
No, I can't explain that. It's too hard for me. Because I can't remember the difference between a watt and a kilowatt hour. What I'll do is say, Google it, and Wikipedia has an article, thank God, for both the 2000 Watt Society of Basel, Zurich, that explains what they're up to as a plan, and it also will link you to what the hell a watt is relative to a kilowatt hour. Sorry, I'm an English major, and so... very often, these kind of techno thoughts are they don't stay in my head. Yes?
Well, greetings from an American who lives in Zurich, Switzerland.
Oh, nice.
So I offer myself as a witness. And I can't explain exactly what the 2,000 watts are either, unfortunately. It's a form of index. I wanted to offer the small correction that the 2,000 Watt Society is not yet fully happening. It's on its way. The target date in Zurich is 2030.
But
we voted for it. It's slowly phasing in. And then I thought, just really, I don't have a question more. I wanted to back you up. Because I come to the United States about once a year. I've been doing that for about 20 years. I feel like Rip Van Winkle. This time I landed in St. Louis and I looked down from the airplane and I saw these vast fields of single-story buildings with flat roofs and no windows. In a society that says fracking is necessary. And I just can't believe it. I can't believe that I have to carry what amounts to winter clothing around in the summer. There are a lot of places, I see a lot of you, most of you, in places like the subway that are really cold to me and you can manage in a t-shirt. I can't. I have lost the ability to want to live in air conditioning. And if you want to explain the difference between the European 6,000 watt index and the American 12,000 watt index, I don't think you have to look much farther than your air conditioning. And when I mentioned this to people in St. Louis, they said, oh, that wouldn't be comfortable. We couldn't live like that. And I don't believe it. But anyway, that was a bit of just experience. And hi from Zurich.
Well, thank you for that. I lived in Zurich myself for 2 years, and I love that town. But my understanding is that the 2,000 Watt Society idea has been tried out by a small experimental crew of people in Basel already. But the interesting thing is that the cities and the cantons have voted in to make it a universal goal of their total population, which is really kind of amazing. Thank you.
Hi. I have maybe actually two questions that are related. Like, having read a number of your books, I feel like, you know, Blue Mars and, like, 2312 are some of the only real concrete examples that I can point to of people actually envisioning what sea level rise might look like. You know, like, the climate change advocates almost never come out and say, oh, you know, all the cities of the world underwater. So one of my questions is, why do you think climate science advocates avoid spelling out the possible consequences when they might help more in terms of convincing the general population about these issues? Mm-hmm. And then my other question is, you know, thinking about utopian futures and what's possible, if all the major cities of the world do go underwater within the next 50, 60 years, is any kind of democratic representative government likely to survive that?
Well, sea level is an interesting question. The estimates of how fast sea level is rising are always off and always being shifted to be going faster than were previously recognized by scientists. And it's a problem because the ice doesn't have to melt. It has to break off of Greenland and Antarctica and fall into the ocean, at which point it's pretty much melted right then. So it's a question of when does it break rather than when it melts. And the West Antarctic ice sheet is sitting on ground that is below sea level, so that if it lifts up in any way, shape, or form, is torn away out to sea, a gigantic chunk of ice that would raise sea levels by something like 6 meters could happen really, really fast. And that was what I did in my Mars trilogy as a quick way to devastate the Earth so that my Martians could become independent. I mean, it was very instrumental at that point. It was a plot point. In 2312, I suggest that in 300 years, the sea level is 11 meters higher, so that Manhattan is substantially underwater and has become like a gigantic Venice. And I recommend this book to all of you New Yorkers for a vision of New York as a gigantic Venice. It's pretty beautiful, pretty high functioning, actually. And only the High Line is actually above, so that you walk the High Line to stay above water, in effect. And a lot of building has gone on between the skyscrapers so that you get suspended between skyscrapers. Now, this is a little bit too fast according to the scientific models that are solidist. I think the reason climate scientists don't talk about it too much is that even at its worst, it will happen slower than that. Even if Greenland were to slide off into the ocean rapidly, the kind of rapidity you're talking about is geological. And so you still have 1,000 years. So it isn't one of those immediate pressure points that you can say that we are in big trouble in the next 30 years. Like you can say if the Arctic sea ice were to melt off and every summer be ocean, open ocean in the Arctic, then we are in terrible trouble because of the feedback loop that's set up. Sunlight goes into the ocean, warms it. That kicks in the process where things get warmer very much faster. If all the ice in Greenland slides into the sea, then sea level is suddenly 7 meters higher. And I once calculated that this would be the equivalent of having about 10,000 Katrina New Orleanses at once. And we weren't that good at New Orleans. And if you think about 10,000 New Orleans Katrina disasters at once, I don't think civilization, you don't have to talk about democratic government, you have to talk about the civilizational shock of all those people moving inland. At that point, we'd either get really, really good at cooperation, or else we would have the infamous collapse and breakdown and, you know, chaos and disorder.
Okay, so when I think about this, one of the things, the biggest insurmountable challenges I have is hope. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you first, if you know all of this, why are you drinking out of a plastic water bottle? Mm-hmm. And do you actually have hope that people might actually want to do this, like put the effort into it to do it? Do you actually have hope?
I do hope. And I must say, not only am I drinking out of a plastic water bottle, but I flew here from California to give this talk. So it gets really bad in carbon burn terms. And I have to say that if you count my domestic life, I just want to wave a little flag of virtue here. that in my domestic life between gardening, composting, and photovoltaics, and bicycling, which have to do not with my personal virtue, but my town's virtue. Davis, California allows you to live a bicycling life, to only put a couple thousand miles per year on your car, et cetera, et cetera. So that if I stayed at home, my carbon burn numbers would be superb. So, you know, I try not to fly except to things that are so fun that I can't possibly say no to them and hope for the best. And I think we all have to do that, and we all have to think about the fact that we all consume and burn carbon, that it's part of our breeding cycle for one thing, but it's also part of living and eating. And so then you have what the Dalai Lama calls mindful consumption. So mindful breathing, mindful consumption. You pay attention to what you consume, and pretty soon you're cleaner, you're cheaper, you're healthier, you're happier. So that mindfulness, I try to exercise and try to get better at it. And everybody should know their carbon burn number like they know their weight, and try not to be obese in the attempt to be healthy. I mean, these are things that I think are coming. And as I think they're coming, I do have hope, but I have hope for two reasons. One, I am biochemically wired very positive, which is due to my mom. God bless her, and thank you for that world. It's a great thing to have. But also, what Gramsci said, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. That as prosperous North Americans, it does not behoove us to be pessimistic, because there are a lot of really poor people who are hopeful, optimistic, and working their butts off for a better life. And for the upper class of the world, the aristocracy of the world, to say, ah, well, we're all doomed. It's a sort of a mask of the Red Death, a sort of a Götterdämmerung response. So I say, keep your hopes up and do what you can, and never give in to this fashionable pessimism that happens to a lot of us on the left, a lot of us in the environmental community, this idea that, you know, because we aren't succeeding right now, and because there's a right wing in America, we are therefore doomed. It's not right. It's just a fight. It's just politics. And then you fight that fight, and you get a certain positive charge out of the little victories, and a certain useful anger out of the defeats, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of defeats, there's a lot of angst, and there is a big catastrophe looming down. So then it becomes prisoner's dilemma. I mean, and when you're playing prisoner's dilemma, what's your best strategy? It actually is hope, and the strategy that the game theorists call always generous. So in other words, instead of trying to analyze the other prisoner and saying, I'll betray them before they betray me, you say, if I'm always generous, even if I get betrayed, I still win. And this is the version of prisoner's dilemma you have to keep in mind.
Will.
I feel bad drinking this now.
In some of your books, you describe alternatives to capitalism. And if that system is really the scorpion on the frog's back, as you said, what does it look like when the stinger is removed? How would that operate? I mean, is there a friendlier animal in general that you could imagine?
Well, thank you for that question, because I have thought about it, and I want to speak first to the radical inadequacy of economics as a field, because this should be their job, not science fiction writers' jobs. Economics should be projective economics, speculative economics, future economics, but not just plain old neoliberal capitalist economics, so much so that the word economics means capitalist law analysis. That's all it means. Economics as ecology doesn't exist and has to be invented by science fiction writers who are not that good at that kind of invention. Don't have the, I mean, I can't even describe a Watt. How can I describe an economy? So I read where I can to try to get help, and there are some alternative economies out there. There's Mondragon Spain that works as nested co-ops. I've often relied on that. And I've thought about capitalism as something that could happen as a sport like rugby or tackle football. Something that happens on the margin, and literally on the economic margin, you can play profit and loss. You can play investment and entrepreneur. But for the necessities, you got food, water, shelter, clothing, healthcare, education as public utilities, as something that we all pay for together, that everybody has. And I think you should include full employment. Work is really one of those necessities too, that full employment be part of it. And then, once you've got all those things set up as something that we do as a collective, therefore as government, therefore as democratic government, and something you do of the people, by the people, for the people, on the margins for your latest iPod tricks, why not have it be capitalist? Who cares? So the market should be driven to the margins, and the necessities be public utilities. And so do we need that in numbers? Yes, we need that worked out as a system that can be described in quantitative and systematic and legal detail. Because when I have like one paragraph, if I go longer than one paragraph describing something in a science fiction novel that isn't the plot and the car chases, I get accused of being like Kim Stanley Robinson, the guy that goes on for 25 pages about a rock, which I swear I have never done, but I read like that. So I have only limited room to give you my economic theories. And not only that, I only have limited ability to think them up. But economics should include that.
In your Mars books, you talked about architectural styles as part of revolution. In your last book, you talked about performance art and earth art. I've been quoting you a lot lately, talking about art as a perfect example of a rugby game on the periphery of capitalism. But I'm wondering just sort of your ideas about the place in an art museum of art in all of this of the next century.
I'm thinking that that art should be not something that we just confine to museums or specialists or to activities, but a way of describing what we do with housing, clothing, even food, the preparation of food. That art should be a way of looking at things. And there is design, utopian design, that tries to take in so that it's not only beautiful to look at as an object, but is also high-functioning, energy efficient. So design is really a utopian field right now, and some of the people working in design are just awesomely good and are doing everything that economics is not doing. So that in almost every field, if you look at it, you say, they're doing utopian work. Their current work, their cutting edge work is utopian and is making a better world, until you look at economics and you say, well, why should that one be missing? It's because it also equals power, politics, privilege. That economics is sort of like astrology in the Middle Ages. It's the way that the ruling class justifies what they're doing to themselves. At least it has that aspect to it. And that it is not a real science like the other sciences or like design. So it's one aspect of how captured it is that it doesn't have that utopian aspect. So we need a utopian economics because it really is kind of fundamental to everything else.
You talked about what we might say to young people, and you also talked about the crisis of meaning in the secular West. But I just wondered what you might say to a young person who perhaps is living in a currently industrializing country or in a low-income country that aspires to a certain kind of life that they see us have and desire for themselves.
Well, that's a complicated thing. I would say that, first of all, certain things that do not exist in the developing world are not luxuries but necessities. That refrigeration is not a Western luxury but is a healthcare necessity through the tropics. So immediately I would say you don't have what you should have, and this is partly a post-colonial situation. And if you were to demand, restitution in the International Criminal Court and some kind of gigantic payment from the developed West to the undeveloped South, that would be right. And I would support that politically with my votes. Then also you have to say to them, you know what, you've still got community, you've still got family, you've still got an outdoor life in the sun. You aren't trapped in a room with your virtual and augmented and computer crap. You aren't alienated yet, possibly. So that as you develop, you need to hold on to the things that overdevelopment and capitalization will lose for you. And not in the rush for refrigeration, go right through it to, luxury sedans. So this is what I would try to say. But to tell you the truth, my opportunities, like the rest of us, my opportunities to talk to poor people in the South are very limited.
Hi, I wanted to go back to your idea of science versus capitalism as two different competing ideological poles. And you brought up this idea of science as the utopian pole. But I'm just curious, in that concept, how do you square all the different ways in which science has colluded with capitalism and power in terms of, you know, military science, food science, statisticians? Where does that fit into that?
The two are like conjoined twins in some gigantic Hindu drama, where they are twins. They began in the same time historically, and they began as a twin system. Capitalism has been as successful as it has, partly because of science, and vice versa. And I said in my Galileo novel that really Galileo and science began with the gun to its head. It was military research to begin with, but it was also medical research. And now we do intensive medical research to try to repair the torn apart bodies of soldiers that the military research has wrecked. So the two are very conjoined. And what I would like to do is de-strand them and say, oftentimes when you're mad at science, you say, oh, I don't like these genetically modified organisms, which you're really mad at and have made a category error about, is you're mad at capitalism, at ownership of the natural world, at privilege, but that science itself is just the ability, the attempt to understand and manipulate nature for comfort. It can be turned to anything because anything can get bought and turned in different directions. There have also been moments of hubris in scientific history, like after World War II, the scientific community, having won the war for the Allies with radar, penicillin, and the atom bomb, then said, we can solve any problem, and so we'll use nuclear power to dig harbors, and we're going to spray your suburban streets with DDT because we are men with white lab coats on and heavy dark glasses and pocket protectors, and they were like the magicians of their age. And that was a moment of hubris that crashed and burned as the planet was poisoned by the post-war science recommendations, and I think science has been humbled by that and is much more modest now. And most of the scientific individuals and institutions are now saying to all of us, science is not the answer, it is just a tool set. And what we do is up to all of us together as citizens. So don't ask scientists what do we do, or you ask them what can we do, and the scientific community is now saying, well, we can and must avoid climate change. This is what the scientific community is saying. Capitalists saying, well, we can't afford it, it doesn't pencil out, and so now survival is not affordable economically. Well, that's really too bad, but it means we have to tweak the economic system, and I think science is the way forward there.
Well, this is going to be a little bit of a downer. We are doomed. And I say this because within the last few years, there have been a couple of very important papers. And they were both published in Nature. First was 2 years ago, and this one arose out of a graduate student seminar in biology at the University of California, Berkeley. And in that seminar, the students decided to calculate current biodiversity loss, the rate of extinction that's going on now, and compare that with the worst mass extinctions in Earth history. And these are, for those who may not know, the terminal Ordovician mass extinction, which occurred roughly around maybe 400 million years ago, the terminal Permian, which is known in some circles as the Great Dying, because maybe as much as 96% of all life went extinct, and that was roughly about 250 million years ago. And then, of course, the famous extinction that killed off the non-avian dinosaurs, the terminal Cretaceous mass extinction about 66.4 million years ago. Their work later led to another study in which they're looking at the current biodiversity loss, and they think we may be at a point of no return. They've asked whether or not we've passed the tipping point, and that was published a year later, last year in Nature. But there is good news, maybe, just maybe. There are some ecologists around who are trying to educate local populations insofar as teaching them how to live with the biota, and not just out in the wild, but even within settlements. It's a type of ecology that's been called reconciliation ecology, and I've heard from someone where it seems to be having some success now in East Africa and maybe some other parts in the Middle East as well. So who knows?
The extinctions are the things that we can't recover from. Life is really robust. there are certain tipping points and things we can't get past that we have to avoid, and the extinctions have already begun, so there are going to be losses. And this is one of the things that I would like to say is that you can flip that. There are going to be losses in this century, and they're going to be significant in terms of extinctions that we can't come back from, other creatures that we are not going to magic back into existence. But there, the question becomes then, how much are you going to lose? But then you flip the question and say, how much are we going to save? And so this is the question that gets you to work harder. How much are we going to save, given that there are going to be some losses, given the situation that we're in already? So I don't think it hurts at all to accentuate the nature of the emergency that we're in, that we only have 30 or 50 years, that we are in a truly unprecedented moment in history where things have to happen that aren't economical and yet are necessary. So it is a really scary time, but nothing is, as long as things haven't gotten extinct, there is landscape restoration, there's assisted migration, there is reconciliation ecology, which is really the game that we're all in now.
Thank you all. Thank you, Stan. And please come back at 4, where Stan will be talking to John Crowley, probably about literature, science fiction, other things. But yeah, thank you, Stan.